In April of 1958, a 22-year-old Hunter S. Thompson wrote a letter on the meaning of life when asked by a friend for advice. What makes his response all the more profound is the fact that, at the time, the world had no idea that he would become one of the most important writers of the 20th century. Therefore, his beliefs about purpose were hypothetical. They were statements of faith. But if it's true that our beliefs really do become our reality, then there's no better example of a life fully realized than the one of Hunter S. Thompson. Let his perspective inspire you. April 22nd, 1958, 57 Perry Street, New York City. Dear Hume, you ask advice. Ah, what a very human and very dangerous thing to do. For to give advice to a man who asks what to do with his life implies something very close to egomania. To presume to point a man to the right and ultimate goal, to point with a trembling finger in the right direction, is something only a fool would take upon himself. I am not a fool, but I respect your sincerity in asking my advice. I ask you, though, in listening to what I say, to remember that all advice can only be a product of the man who gives it. What is truth to one may be disaster to another. I do not see life through your eyes, nor you through mine. If I were to attempt to give you specific advice, it would be too much like the blind leading the blind. To be or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles. Shakespeare. And indeed, that is the question, whether to float with the tide or swim for a goal. It is a choice we must all make consciously or unconsciously at one time in our lives. So few people understand this. Think of any decision you've ever made which had a bearing on your future. I may be wrong, but I don't see how it could have been anything but a choice, however indirect, between the two things I've mentioned, the floating or the swimming. But why not float if you have no goal? That is another question. It is unquestionably better to enjoy the floating than to swim in uncertainty. So how does a man find a goal? Not a castle in the stars, but a real and tangible thing. How can a man be sure he's not after the big rock candy mountain, the enticing sugar candy goal that has little taste and no substance? The answer, and in a sense the tragedy of life, is that we seek to understand the goal and not the man. We set up a goal which demands of us certain things, and we do these things. We adjust to the demands of a concept which cannot be valid. When you were young, let us say that you wanted to be a fireman. I feel reasonably safe in saying that you no longer want to be a fireman. Why? Because your perspective has changed. It's not the fireman who has changed, but you. Every man is the sum total of his reactions to experience. As your experience differ and multiply, you become a different man, and hence your perspective changes. This goes on and on. Every reaction is a learning process. Every significant experience alters your perspective. So it would seem foolish, would it not, to adjust our lives to the demands of a goal we see from a different angle every day? How could we ever hope to accomplish anything other than galloping neuroses? The answer then must not deal with goals at all, or not with tangible things, anyway. It would take reams of paper to develop this subject to fulfillment. God only knows how many books have been written on the meaning of man and that sort of thing. And God only knows how many people have pondered the subject. I use the term God only knows purely as an expression. There's very little sense in my trying to give it up to you in the proverbial nutshell, because I'm the first to admit my absolute lack of qualifications for reducing the meaning of life to one or two paragraphs. I'm going to steer clear of the word existentialism, but you might keep it in mind as a key of sorts. You might also try something called Being and Nothingness by Jean-Paul Sartre, and another little thing called existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre. These are merely suggestions. If you're genuinely satisfied with what you are and what you're doing, then give those books a wide berth. Let sleeping dogs lie. But back to the answer. As I said, to put our faith in tangible goals would seem to be, at best, unwise. So we do not strive to be firemen. We do not strive to be bankers, nor policemen, nor doctors. We strive to be ourselves. But don't misunderstand me. I don't mean that we can't be firemen, bankers, or doctors, but that we must make the goal conform to the individual rather than make the individual conform to the goal. In every man, heredity and environment have combined to produce a creature of certain abilities and desires, including a deeply ingrained need to function in such a way that his life will be meaningful. A man has to be something. He has to matter. As I see it, the formula runs something like this. A man must choose a path which will let his abilities function at maximum efficiency toward the gratification of his desires. In doing this, he is fulfilling a need, giving himself identity by functioning in a set pattern toward a set goal. He avoids frustrating his potential, choosing a path which puts no limit on his self-development. And he avoids the terror of seeing his goal wilt or lose its charm as he draws closer to it, rather than bending himself to meet the demands of that which he seeks. He has bent his goal to conform to his own abilities and desires. In short, he has not dedicated his life to reaching a predefined goal, but he has, rather, chosen a way of life he knows he will enjoy. The goal is absolutely secondary. It is the functioning toward the goal which is important, and it seems almost ridiculous to say that a man must function in a pattern of his own choosing. For to let another man define your own goals is to give up one of the most meaningful aspects of life, the definitive act of will, which makes a man an individual. Let's assume that you think you have a choice of 8 paths to follow, all predefined paths, of course. And let's assume that you can't see any real purpose in any of the 8. Then, and here is the essence of all I said, you must find a 9th path. Naturally, it isn't as easy as it sounds. You've lived a relatively narrow life, a vertical rather than a horizontal existence. So it isn't any too difficult to understand why you seem to feel the way you do. But a man who procrastinates in his choosing will inevitably have his choice made for him by circumstance. So if you now number yourself among the disenchanted, then you have no choice but to accept things as they are, or to seriously seek something else. But beware of looking for goals. Look for a way of life. Decide how you want to live, and then see what you can do to make a living within that way of life. But you say, I don't know where to look. I don't know what to look for. And there's the crux. Is it worth giving up what I have to look for something better? I don't know. Is it? Who can make that decision but you? But even by deciding to look, you go a long way toward making the choice. If I don't call this to a halt, I'm going to find myself writing a book. I hope it's not as confusing as it looks at first glance. Keep in mind, of course, that this is my way of looking at things. I happen to think that's a pretty generally applicable way, but you may not. Each of us has to create our own credo. This merely happens to be mine. If any part of it doesn't seem to make sense, by all means, call it to my attention. I'm not trying to send you out on the road in search of Valhalla, but merely pointing out that it is not necessary to accept the choices handed down to you by life as you know it. There is more to it than that. No one has to do something he doesn't want to do for the rest of his life. But then again, if that's what you wind up doing, by all means, convince yourself that you had to do it. You'll have lots of company. And that's it for now. Until I hear from you again, I remain your friend, Hunter. Welcome to Art House Radio. This is episode 25. 85. 25. 25. Or 25. I don't know. I forget. My Spanish is terrible. Those wonderful sirens you're hearing are sounds of the Lansing Police Department. Who knows where they're going? I hope everybody's all right. So that opening was Hunter S. Thompson. Somebody posted on Reddit. I think the person who posted it was called Self Psychonaut. In an earlier episode, I used the word psychonaut, and I had a definition for it, and I gave it, and I've since forgotten it, so clearly I'm an idiot. But that's the way things go, right? I can't remember everything. New things have been crammed in there, and old things have been pushed out. Just in and out. The old in and out. This is an episode about Hunter S. Thompson, as you heard, but not really about him. I just wanted to read that thing because I thought it was really inspirational. It was a good way to think about it. I'd never thought about the idea of floating or swimming towards a goal. I would only take one issue with what he said, and that is, I'm not sure that it has to be one or the other. I mean, I think you could choose to do one or the other, but you could also choose to do both. For example, I tend to think of myself as a floater. That sounds really terrible. Floating in the water, because I find it relaxing, and I don't like to feel like there's a need to go somewhere. And I compose music like that, too. I just want to exist in the moment, and I don't want to think like it's some sort of insignificant preamble to something else. Like we're always striving to be somewhere. I want to be in the now and enjoy it, and that's the way I compose, and that's a reflection of how my life is. I mean, I write a lot of music. I do a lot of video, and all of a sudden I'm 75 years old and working at Kmart. That's just the way that I am. I love money like everybody else, but I've always struggled with it because I'm a drifter. I'm a Huckleberry Finn. I'm a Tom Sawyer. I just want to float down the river and be like, "What's up, man? Let's just relax. Look at that tree, you know? Look at those plants. Do you smell that? Let's twist another one and just look at the water and how it reacts when it hits the bank." That's pretty much what I do. But that doesn't mean I haven't had goals in my life. I haven't achieved accomplishments. Believe it or not, I have. So for example, finishing my degree, I've got a few of them, just to plug my intelligence there. I'd like to take a moment to plug my intelligence and talk about my degrees. I have several of them, a bag full. If I were an Olympic athlete, I'd be Michael Phelps, still working at Kmart. Not that there's anything wrong with working at Kmart. I'm just taking the piss. It's fine. There's no job that I sort of look at in a condescending manner. We all do it because we have to survive. I get it. But I was happy to complete those degrees. So that would be a goal. So if I was floating on the water, I would have seen this little siren or siren or however you say it, sort of just standing there glistening. And swimming towards it is what I would have done. And I grabbed it and I got up there and I accomplished it. And then I went back in the water and I floated for a while. So I like to think that I do both. What do you do? Just let me know. I want to know if you're a floaty type person or if you're a goal driven person. And do you think you could switch? Do you like to do both? At Spanish Peanuts, at Arthouse 43, you can go to arthouse43.com or troymeetsworld.com and just let me know. Come on, some of you email me and I love it. It's great. I get emails from different places. New Zealand, America, a little place called America. Sometimes the Canadians email me. That's great. I love Canada. It's fantastic. If you haven't been, you really should go. It's pretty great, I think. A lot of people think, actually. So. But that's enough about Hunter S. Thompson. I was thinking the other day that people, when they ask me, what do you listen to? Because you're into music, you studied it, you compose, all that. Well, what do you listen to? And I always feel like I give like a terrible answer because I can't think of anything. And I'm like, James Brown, even though I've never listened to James Brown ever. And I'm like, yeah, James Brown is cool. I just can't think of anything in the moment. So I thought, why not just take a podcast episode, maybe several. And every once in a while, just find a composer that I love and sort of just, you know, serve it up to you like I'm making you dinner or something, and I'm just going to put it on a plate in front of you and be like, enjoy this. I like this, so let's see if you like this too. And you can, at the time, pretend that you like it, and then afterwards go like, oh, that was awful. Never again. I'm going to ghost that guy. You know. But Philip Glass, that's who I want to talk about. Philip Glass. A lot of people who are into music know him already. But you know what? A lot of people don't. And especially people who aren't really into music, classical music or new classical music. Wait, don't leave. I said the C word, classical music. Just hold on. Just stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Because for two reasons. One, I think you might like it. It's very modern and it's beautiful. Those are a couple of reasons, actually. But the second main reason is that you already know Philip Glass, probably, because he's done film scores for a lot of movies. Now, he's not a film score composer necessarily, but he has done that thing. And he's done some great ones, like the movie The Hours, Dracula. He redid the Bela Lugosi soundtrack. You probably haven't seen that one. But there are others. You'd be surprised at how many he's done. And I thought, I just want to talk about that. So let's do that. Can we, please? Great. So let's rewind the clock a little bit. I was taking music courses at a community college in Battle Creek, and I first learned of Philip Glass through some people there. And seemed like they were kind of interested in it, but not really. Like it was the minimalistic, repetitive nature of it that was sort of a turnoff. Let me just say first of all that minimalism in music is obvious, but it's just the repetition of sound. So it's just na 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 na. But then it changes slightly, you know, maybe goes up a little bit, or just like, it's very soothing. I think it's wonderful. There are some people who hate it. There are many people who hate it because they don't think it's complex enough or it's challenging enough to them as listeners or as musicians. So there are some haters out there, but you know, you kind of got to get past that. So when I was first introduced to Philip Glass, I heard the highly repetitive stuff. And it's interesting when you discover music, like what you discover about them first can sometimes turn you off to them or turn you on to them or shape your whole experience of your interaction with them. And, but if you stick with it long enough and you get the whole picture, then at least if you're going to reject it, then it's a little bit more just. But my first reaction or interaction with Philip Glass was of what some people perceive as the terrible stuff, like this. So when I say terrible stuff, that's not my opinion, but it is sort of an introduction to Philip Glass that can really test your sanity. because that stuff goes on for a long time, just over and over, and it slowly changes, as you heard, right? And that can be challenging. And I don't remember if I liked it or if I was kind of put off by it, but for some reason, I kind of liked it, and I stuck with it a little bit, or at least enough to try different things. And I remember going to the library and checking out different scores or different CDs. If you're under 25, a CD is a little square thing, that, or you know, the case, and then the CD itself is round like a record. It's like a little record for those of you who are digital natives, right? For us digital immigrants, we remember CDs. So when I did that, and I'm trying to do this in a chronological order, my experience with Philip Glass and why I ended up loving him so much. So the next thing that I remember, and I could have this all screwed up, but the next thing that I remember was interacting with one of his film scores, and it was a foreign film called Koyaanisqatsi. And it's a film, I think it's one of three films, but Koyaanisqatsi was the first one that I listened to the soundtrack. And I had never seen the movie. And in fact, I only first saw it a couple of years ago. But the music, I used to listen to it and smoke and take a bath, and it was just so wonderful. And it just was almost like it would induce like a trance-like state. And I remember the first time I heard it, and I was just like immersed in it. So that's Koyaanisqatsi. By the way, I'm only playing clips because I don't want to get in trouble because this stuff is copyrighted, and I hate that I can't play the whole thing for you. I would like this podcast to be 4 hours long where I play the entire work for you because that's what this show is. I don't want to give sound bites, and I feel like that's what I'm doing. And this is part of the reason why I haven't talked about some of my favorite composers, because I don't want to just describe it with words. That's another art form. It's like, I'm going to take pictures and put them on Instagram of my fashion rendition of Philip Glass's Einstein on the Beach work. That's stupid. So I'm just playing as much as I can, as much as I think I can get away with. If you're Philip Glass, for some reason this gets to him or to the record company, I'm just doing this for educational purposes. I'm not making any money off this podcast yet. So I hope that's okay. But the movie Koyaanisqatsi, to get back to it, is so incredible. If you haven't seen it, you have to. It's maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and it's basically all music, and it's like a time lapse videos, a sequence of videos, of people, and it'll show like, because it gets fast paced, and it'll show people in New York City or Chicago just moving like at a fast pace, and the traffic going on the highway, and then downtown, and then lights shimmering, and then the sun goes down and goes up. It's putting a mirror up to us and saying like, look at what you fools are doing. Or maybe you're not a fool. Maybe this is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to move at this pace. We're supposed to lessen our quality time with each other, our interactions, and we're just supposed to be like bees or like ants, and just sort of hurry about our day and have less and less downtime and leisure time. I don't know. But then the movie will transition to nature, and you'll see that stuff. It's a really interesting and fantastic look at human life. It's something that will change your perspective of it forever, I think. But the music is what I heard first, and I love that too. Now, as we drift through Troy's personal interaction with Philip Glass's music, his sort of repertoire of work, the next thing that happens that I remember is buying a CD that he scored for the movie, the original Dracula with Bela Lugosi. I can't tell you how many times I've listened to this CD, and something happened. This is one of the last periods of my life also where I remember buying music tangibly in person. And I remember it had like a cover, and you pull it off and you look at it and you open the inside jacket and you look at the music and you look at the notes and you look at the artwork, and I kind of miss that, you know. I miss that connection that we have with things, and I did that with this. And I remember it's this beautiful CD, and I listened to it so much. If this were a record, I would have listened to it so much that it wouldn't work anymore. I mean, I just listened to it over and over again. It was so beautiful, and it really made me want to write string quartets. And I still am feeding off that energy. And we're talking, this is like 12, 15 years ago, that I maybe longer. I don't remember when it came out, but. It really made me want to compose and be a better composer, but to do it in my own style. I didn't want to copy his style, but I always felt like I was kind of a slow moving person. And I felt like Philip Glass's music, not the high paced stuff from the 70s and 80s and the Philip Glass ensemble and all that you first heard the clip, but the very slow moving stuff that just sort of, it repeats, but it's like a slow moving stream that just moves. It doesn't go faster. It doesn't go slower. It just kind of moves. And I mean, I had such a connection with that. It's so beautiful. So if you haven't heard it, you should. And it's one of those things that they are very, it's one of those things on YouTube that gets taken down immediately. I don't know how they determine that, you know, like some people, if you try to find something on YouTube, you can find almost everything, but there's always like those one or two albums that like they just will take down like in a second. Dracula, the score by Philip Glass, is one of those things that gets taken down. You can find some clips on there, but it doesn't last for very long. So it's a great CD. You should listen to it. I recommend it. It comes highly Troy recommended. And after I got to learn more about this side of Philip Glass. You can see the transition here. It started off with this highly energetic stuff, moved into Koyaanisqatsi, and now we're at Dracula, which has a different feel. It feels more melodic. It's warm. It's inviting. It's very, comforting in a way. There's a thickness to it that sort of just comes over you or washes over you. And I started, after a while, getting into the idea of, well, what else can this guy do? Okay, I get the sense. I've listened to the symphonies even. And is there anything else? What else does he do? Does he do anything different, or does he need to? And that's when I discovered Einstein on the Beach. To me, this is very conceptual. This is something that if you had like a conceptual art class in the arts department, and then you had a contemporary music class in the music department, and they were covering Philip Glass and they were covering conceptual art, you could put those people together. And you probably should, because I bet you Philip Glass and these people, they all knew of each other. They were aware, especially if they were in New York or in LA. They knew of each other. And this work, Einstein on the Beach, just kind of blew me away, because I started thinking, oh, it's an opera, but it doesn't sound like an opera. He's playing with it. He's not making fun of it, but he's just doing something different, something interesting, where people count off. Like, you wouldn't do, I don't even know if that had ever been done before Einstein on the Beach. Maybe. I'm sure there were mid-20th century people, Cage and Menotti. These are all opera composer names or composers anyway. But the way that this was done, and if you listen to the whole work, it's like 4 hours. So, you know, you got to set some time aside. Whatever. It's worth it, I think. You don't have to do it every day. It's not like working out. You know, you do it once and you've done it. Just do it. But it really blew me away, because it was such a conceptual work, and the idea really freed me from everything. I remember hearing an interview with Noel Gallagher from Oasis, and they were talking about Johnny Marr and the Smiths, but also, oh shit, what's that other band, the other British band? I'm going to totally forget. The Stone Roses. And Noel Gallagher was saying, like, I love Johnny Marr and I love the Smiths and everything, but they seemed like these were like Oxford boys or Cambridge boys, and they were so smart in the way they did music. and you liked them, but you didn't know if you could do what they did. But then Noel Gallagher said he heard the Stone Roses, who only put out like one or two albums, but they were fantastic. But they were like just lads down at the pub drinking a pint who did these great albums. And he was like, that was the first time that somebody like me was successful like that. So I felt like I could do that. And that's kind of what Einstein and the Beach and almost all of Philip Glass's works mean to me. It isn't just that I like them. It isn't just that they put me in a state, a wonderful state. It's that it gave me this sort of inspiration or hope that, like, I can do this. I think I can do this, and I think I have my own voice. I just got to find it. And that's why I love him so much, because especially when you have Einstein on the Beach, because it isn't just minimalist. It isn't just repetition. It isn't just, you know, these soothing sounds that sort of float in and out like new age stuff. It can be complicated and it can be interesting with and complex within that context of minimalism. There's a whole world in there. It isn't just a one thing. You go in there and it's everybody banging on the wall for 3 hours. That's not what it is. It's so much more than that. You just have to sort of retune your mind or retune your musical taste buds to get into it. And thinking about all this as if there needed to be any more. I just have one more work that I wanted to share with you. And it's the soundtrack that a score that he wrote to the movie The Hours with Meryl Streep and Nicole Kidman. What a great movie. Very sad. But the music is just so beautiful. And this is one that you can find online. It's been up for a long time. And I used to be a barista in Portland, Oregon. Shout out to Urban Grind. Yo, yo. Anyway, I used to put it on there all the time, and people would come up and say, like, what is this? This is wonderful. And it's so beautiful. And let's just get a taste of it right now. It's wonderful, and I've listened to this so many times, and there are so many other works to explore, you know, and I hope that this maybe sort of breaks down some barriers if you don't know Philip Glass's work, or you'd heard of him, but you hadn't really listened to him. He's great, and I think his work is great, and if you want to explore it more, or experience it for the first time, or all over again, you should, because it's music, and that's, you don't need to know anything about it. There isn't anything to uncover. It's like going to a museum, and sometimes people feel like they're intimidated, or they look at it and they can't figure it out. There's nothing to figure out. You just listen to it. You just close your eyes and you listen to it, and you maybe drink a Miller High Life. This is not a show that's sponsored by Miller High Life. I'm just saying you could drink one. I happen to drink it, but whatever, you know, pick your thing, man, and just lay back and enjoy it. The Hours, Philip Glass. It's beautiful. Thank you. thank you for listening. You've been listening to episode number 25 of Art House Radio. Whew, it's been a long run. I'm happy to do this. It's fun. Tweet at me at Spanish Peanuts. That's really where you want to go, at Spanish Peanuts. Or you want to go to the website, TroyMeetsWorld.com, and write me a message. I think arthouse43.com, there's some issue with the email thing. So if you've tried to do that, I'm sorry, I'll fix that. But go to TroyMeetsWorld.com, send me a message, just fill out that form, or at Spanish Peanuts, and follow me and I'll follow you back. You know, that's how this works. Then we can message each other or whatever. Just get a hold of me. Let me know you're out there. This show was supported by people who go to sites like TroyMeetsWorld.com or Arthouse 43. They click on donate and then they make donations based on their ability to make donations resource-wise. Everybody can figure it out. I just mean, like, where's your bank account at? That kind of ability. Like, you should, come on, like, let's do this. Let's keep this show going if you like it. If you don't, then I understand why you won't give any money. But, you know, that's the way it goes. I'll just work at Long John Silver's for 5 more years until I figure things out. You know, just live with that burden or that guilt that that's what you're doing to me, that I have to come home after a long day of fish and chips frying and make this podcast and create music and all that. Really, it's fine. No worries. It's okay. We need your support. Creative projects are never free. And any support you could give would be greatly appreciated. Well, I've got some good interviews coming up. Should be some interesting things. I've got a friend out in Portland who's going to have a show on a radio station. Exciting. I'll talk more about that next time. I think she wants to come on. I won't say her name yet, but you know who you are. We'll have a discussion, plug the show, other friends from Portland and Michigan and wherever else. If you like interviews, this is gonna be a good spring and summer, people. Okay, I'm tired of doing this. I want you to have a great day. Enjoy it. Just lay back and relax. Do some yoga, some meditation, and just get those terrible thoughts out. And everything's gonna be just fine, my friends. Until next time.